This morning's story, we're going to be in Judges chapter 16. Judges chapter 16 is the story specifically of Samson and Delilah. But this is actually a much broader story than that. You may or may not realize it, but we'll get to it. But you can turn to Judges 16, where we'll be here in a few moments. But last week, we saw through the account of Rahab and the spies that discipleship and growing in our relationship with God are just our journey and understanding who God has called us to be when He calls us out of darkness into salvation, who that is and who He wants us to become and how He wants to transform us and change us. It's a messy process, and it requires our genuine belief first and our trust in God to say, I trust You. I trust You with my future. I trust You with my soul. And so I'm going to trust You with my present and let You change me and challenge me and grow me. And that trust demonstrates itself through our acting in complete faith as God cleans up our sinful, messy lives. And it is a messy process. It is a long process. But we saw that in the story of Rahab and the spies. And that story, that account took place just as Joshua, the leader of Israel, was finally leading the children of Israel into the promised land, into Canaan after 40 years. They were finally going into that land that God promised their ancestor Abraham. And so as the people settled, to give you the context for where we're going in Judges chapter 16, as the people settle in that land, the land that God promised Abraham, their ancestor, and they finally get to inherit, Joshua, what we find out is that Joshua is the glue that really holds these 12 tribes, these people, this large nation. He's really the glue that holds them all together. But when Joshua dies, we're going to see here in a moment, everything falls apart. In Judges chapter 2, verses 7 to 8, but also all the way through verse 12, we read that the people served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua and of the elders who outlived him and who had seen all the great things the Lord had done for Israel. Joshua, son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, though, died at the age of 110. And after that whole generation had been gathered to their ancestors, meaning they had passed away as well, another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what He had done for Israel. So then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served the Baals. They forsook the Lord, the God of their ancestors, who brought them out of Egypt, and they followed and worshipped various gods of the peoples around them. They aroused the Lord's anger because they forsook Him and served Baal and the Asherahs. And so this failure, this turning to other gods, this faithlessness to God, their God, is the theme of the time period of the Judges. The children of Israel, if you read Judges from beginning to end, they have this tendency towards faithlessness to God. They didn't drive out all the inhabitants of Canaan, they were supposed to, in full obedience to God. And they intermarried with the inhabitants of the current inhabitants of the land in disobedience to God. And so those failures to not drive them out and don't intermarry with them because they worship other gods, they're not God-fearing people. And that the warning was they're going to draw you away from God. Those failures come back again and again because the children of Israel demonstrate in the book of Judges this tendency towards idolatry because it becomes interwoven in their families and interwoven in their cultures because they didn't initially obey God. And so the theme of Judges is that God's people fail, and when they fail, God allows the consequence, the punishment that comes with their failure, and specifically being overtaken and ruled by a foreign people. And then, this is the cycle of Judges, the people notice, hey, we're oppressed, this isn't good, it's probably our fault. And so they call out to God for deliverance, and so God sends a judge to deliver them and rule over them. Now, when we say judge, I don't think the gown, right? Don't think the gown and like someone sitting at a bench. A judge in the Hebrew world and in this culture is really more of a military leader. He is a leader, he's an administrator, but it's somebody that comes in and delivers. That's this type of judge here. It's a word that we just don't have a good translation for in English, and so we get our closest one, and that, for whatever reason, is judge. And so that's the cycle. They fail. There's consequences through oppression. They cry out to God. God delivers them through a judge. They fail. And then there's consequence through oppression. They cry out because of their failure, and God sends a judge. And this cycle happens about 14 times through the book of Judges over approximately 350 years. It's the same thing over and again. And when the judge comes to deliver them, it's because God called them to deliver and called them to administrate the children of Israel. And the deliverance that they brought was often, the judge that brought the deliverance was often dramatic. And if you have read the book of Judges, there are some pretty intense accounts, pretty fascinating accounts. I'll leave this little for you. There's one account where a judge delivers by killing a king and then escaping through the toilet. That's a good one. You can search for that one on your own if you want to find it, but I'm a big fan of that one just because it's fascinating and disgusting at all the same time. But there's some pretty interesting accounts in this book. And Samson, the guy that we are looking at this morning, Samson is the last judge in the book. He's not the last judge overall. That was Samuel, and some of you may not even realize that Samuel was a judge. But Samson is the last judge in this book that we're looking at this morning, and possibly the most famous. If you were to mention any of the judges' names to someone outside of the church even, they actually may recognize Samson's name. He's pretty famous. Especially because of the account that we're going to look at this morning, people even probably recognize that Delilah is a name that not everybody wants because of this account. And so this morning, the account that we're looking at occurs at the end of Samson's story, and it begins in Judges chapter 16, and we're going to look at verse 4 if you would follow along with me. This is regarding Samson. So sometime later, Samson, fell in love with a woman in the valley of Sorek whose name was Delilah. The rulers of the Philistines went to her and said, "See if you can lure him into showing you the secret of his great strength and how we can overpower him so that we may tie him up and subdue him. Each of us will give you 1,100 shekels of silver." And so Delilah said to Samson, "Tell me the secret of your great strength and how you can be tied up and subdued." I love that she's not that subtle. She's like, "So how can I go about this? Let's try this. Can you tell me how you're so strong and what I can do to, end that strength?" Like, there's not a lot of tact there, right? She just goes, she's like, "Okay, I can ask him." But these verses, those verses, this is the setup for the final chapter in Samson's life. He falls in love with this Philistine woman named Delilah, and the Philistine rulers offer her at least, because there's at least three of them, so they offer her at least 3,000 shekels of silver to discover how they can capture Samson. And that's not a little bit of money. It's at least 85, and they measured, shekels are a weight. And so they measured this weight in pounds, if we can do that. So that's at least 85 pounds of silver. That is not a little bit of money. That is a lot of money, which means that these guys, these rulers, want Samson bad. They're willing to pay a lot for this. Why? Why do they want Samson so bad? And the answer is because Samson is the judge of Israel. And Samson has a particular gift from God to aid him in his role as judge. Samson is supernaturally strong, and that superhuman strength has been an ongoing nuisance for the Philistines for years. And so Delilah accepts the offer. You see that in her reaction. She accepts the offer and asks Samson, hey, so what's the secret of your strength? And playing off of his affection for her, right? He loves her, and so she thinks, okay, he loves me. He's really into me. He'll tell me if I ask him. And she probably bats her eyelashes, you know, really, really carefully to try to see if he can, you know, look at my eyes. I love you, Samson. Can you tell me? Now, you're likely familiar here with the story, most of you, and what happens and how Samson's story ends. And if not, that's okay. We're going to get there and tell you about it. But often when we deal with this account, this last chapter of Samson's life, we deal with it as its own story, Samson and Delilah. And it's a story of a man betrayed by love, right? And then acting the hero in one final act of defiance, right? If you're familiar with his story. But Samson's story is much more complex than that. And this final chapter with Delilah and how it ends has many layers to it. And so before we can understand Samson's missteps with Delilah here and then his heroic end, if you want to call it that, we need to see how he got to this point altogether. So, Samson's story actually starts in Judges chapter 13. You can turn there if you want, but I also have the verses that we're looking at here on the screen. But his story actually starts in Judges chapter 13, where we discover that Samson is born during one of Israel's periods of consequence for doing evil in the eyes of the Lord. Which usually means that they abandoned their obedience and worship of him for the worship of false gods. That's when Samson was born. In this case, the consequence was living under the oppressive rule of the Philistines. They were centered in Gaza. If you're familiar with the geography of Israel at all, if you can imagine Israel in your mind, to the southwest is the Gaza Strip. There's a lot of conflict over it today. That's where the Philistines were from. That's where they were centered. That's where their capital was. They were centered there in Gaza. So they were, right, one of the more ancient ancestors of the Palestinians, even today. And so that's the oppressive rule that the Israelites were under the Philistines, and they were over the Israelites because they did evil in the eyes of the Lord. And so Samson's birth is the signal to us in this book of Judges that God intends again to intervene, that God is going to deliver his people from the rule of these Philistines through a judge, which an angel reveals to Samson's parents. In Judges chapter 13, verse 5, the angel says this very clearly. He says to Samson's mom, you will become pregnant, and you're going to have a son whose head is never to be touched by a razor, because the boy is to be a Nazarite, dedicated to God from the womb. He will take the lead in delivering Israel from the hands of the Philistines. So God is saying, all right, I'm sending a judge. This time the judge is going to be your son. Samson is going to be that judge. And so Samson's mom gives us one more important detail just a little bit later in verse 7 in the book, that the angel mentioned her, that Samson, yes, is going to be a Nazarite of God from the womb. She adds this detail that she hears, verse 7, that says, until the day of his death. So this is an important detail. It doesn't sound important, but it is. So you may not be familiar with what a Nazarite is, what they're mentioning here, and you may be wondering what that means. It's a really great question. I'm glad you asked, because I actually have an answer prepared for you this morning. So it seems like you came the right morning, because you came in wondering, man, what's a Nazarite? Great. Let's talk about that. So in the book of Numbers, God gives instructions for people who might want to voluntarily dedicate themselves to God. Like, you might want to dedicate yourself to God, to yield yourself to God's service completely. I want my life to be whatever he wants me to do. I don't want to be a blacksmith. I don't want to be, you know, a cooper. That's what we would call them. I don't want to be, you know, anyone that does anything with leather, right? I want to be yielded completely to whatever God wants me to do voluntarily. They were called, someone who wanted to do that was called a separated one. The meaning, they were separated for God. They were separated to God by choice. And in Hebrew, separated one is the word Nazarite. And so this vow, the commitment of the separated ones, the Nazarites, would be made to God and came with very specific restrictions. This is important for our story this morning. They came with very specific restrictions from God directly for the duration that the vow was made. So these were the restrictions for the Nazarite, the separated one who said, I'm going to do whatever God wants me to do for this period of time. Specifically, one, no wine or fermented drinks of any kind, vinegar, no grape products, nothing like that. Nothing from grapes. So they can't eat raisins, they can't do anything like that. No grape juice, right? None of that. No wine, no fermented drinks, nothing with vinegar in it, none of that. That's rule number one. You can't drink it at all, eat it, touch it. Number two, they can't cut their hair for any reason until the period of commitment was over. Their long hair that wasn't cut comes with very specific restrictions, and so they can't even comb their hair because they might pull out some of the hair. So this is part of it, and so they won't comb it. And so when you hear later on that Samson has seven braids, what they really just mean is probably dreadlocks. There was not combed hair. His hair, they don't want to pull anything out, so they were very careful with it. So they don't cut their hair. It's their symbol of their dedication. And number three, they can't touch corpses. Not that many of us run into that situation too often, but they can't touch corpses. Don't go near them. Don't even be in their direct presence. And this isn't just the corpse of a person. This would also be the corpse of an animal or something like that. You don't go near death in any way. That was the rule. Those are the rules. Nothing with grapes. Don't cut your hair. Don't go near death. Those are the three rules for their service. And likely the most difficult restriction was probably the grape one, right? Nothing with any sort of grape connection to it was probably the most difficult one for most Nazarites. And many Nazarites, separated ones, weren't Nazarites for life, just for a specified duration. There was a bold anticipation with the vow that for this duration I'm going to do great things because I've dedicated myself to God, that he's going to do great things through this. And so Samson, long story long, Samson, according to this angel and his mom, was called by God to be a Nazarite, to be a separated one, separated to God, for God, for a specific purpose. And that purpose, evidently, God has said, was to deliver and lead Israel from the Philistines. And the duration of his commitment, the duration of his separation, his vow, according to his mom, was from the womb until his death. That is a long vow for a Nazarite to make in this case. Most did not make their vows for their entire life. It appears that part of his separation to God involved, though, that God was going to bless him, give him supernatural, superhuman strength. Now, it's important to note that Samson did not choose this vow. That's important for the story. Samson didn't choose this vow. He was called to this separation by God and dedicated by his parents, and it seems that this, as we read his story, causes him some significant tension in life, that he didn't choose this life. That who God has called him to be and who Samson wants to be are not the same things. As we read this story, his account, there's a tension between who God has called him to be and who Samson wants to be. There's a very, very clear tension. God has called him to be the judge, to be a deliverer, to be an administrator of Israel, but it seems that Samson just wants to be. Samson doesn't want that. He just wants to be. And particularly what we infer as we look through his story is that Samson doesn't actually want to be Israelite. He doesn't see himself as an Israelite, as a child of Israel. He wants to be Philistine. He grew up, he was born in a Philistine town. He grew up in a Philistine region. And it seems, as we read his account, that Samson just wants to be like everybody else. He wants to be a Philistine who, it's important to also point out, culturally shave their heads. None of them have long hair. That'll come back here in a moment. And so he's called to separation to God, but he's pulled to the Philistine culture, the culture of the day. And specifically, we see this through the company he keeps. when we read his story. The company he keeps, Philistine. The women he's interested in and attracted to, Philistine. The places that he visits, he's drawn to Philistine regions and Philistine towns. His attitude in general towards the Philistines is a positive one, and one where he doesn't want to be on their bad side. And he, like I said, he has a weakness for Philistine women. And so he impulsively marries a Philistine woman early in life, which God allows because God's going to use it to force Samson into his role of deliverer from the Philistines. But long story short, through that marriage, that first marriage with this Philistine woman, a confrontation happens with the Philistines of the region like God intended. But when the dust settles, and I'm just summarizing the story, when the dust settles from Samson's superhuman vendetta against them, he realizes, his head clears and he realizes, I'm in conflict. I'm in conflict with the Philistines, and so Samson hides in a cave, showing I didn't want to do this. Right? He wants to marry the Philistine, not be in conflict with the Philistine. And so when God forces him into the conflict, he goes, "What am I doing? I don't want to do this." So he runs and hides. I don't want to be in conflict with the Philistines. I like them. I want to be a part of their culture. And again, conflict is provoked with the Philistines after this, which Samson is trying to avoid, and he ends up killing 1,000 Philistines with a donkey's jawbone. You may be familiar with that story. And again, looking at the carnage, Samson reveals that he's frustrated and disgusted with what just happened, with the fact that he was forced into this role, and he reluctantly, though, accepts the role as leader of Israel, but tries very hard not to have conflict with the Philistines. He demonstrates he wants to be Philistine. He doesn't want to be separated by God. He doesn't want to be called by God. He doesn't want to be in conflict with them. He wants to be like them. He wants to live his life. And in fact, to this point in his life, when we get to this story of Samson and Delilah, Samson has broken 2 of the 3 restrictions for the Nazarite. He has touched and been near countless corpses. He's eaten honey out of the corpse of a lion. He has broken that one many times. He's held the dead jawbone of a donkey and used it as a weapon to kill more people. He has been in and caused more death than most people ever, right? And he's also had wine and the fruit of grapes at different celebrations. And so Samson has already broken 2 of the 3 vows, the rules for a Nazarite. The only thing remaining of his vow, his commitment, is his hair, which if shaved is the symbol of that the commitment and call from God in his life is over. Which brings us to Samson and Delilah. Samson has revealed that he has little interest in what God has called him to do. He doesn't want to be against the Philistines. He wants to be Philistine. He just wants to be one of them. He wants to be his own man, and he just wants to live his life and be a part of the culture. But God keeps pushing him into this role, this conflict that he doesn't want. And so he reluctantly leads Israel for 20 years. We find out that after the second conflict, he says, "All right, fine, I'll lead." But he's still resisting this conflict. Verse 20 of chapter 15, Samson led Israel for 20 years in the days of the Philistines. And so, yes, he leads them, but notice it's still the days of the Philistines. It's not he delivered them from the Philistines. He led Israel in the days of the Philistines. And there are still, in our story, rulers of the Philistines. So Samson's not delivering, right? He hasn't delivered, because that's his job, but he's not following God's call. And we find in chapter 16, verse 4, that after that, that he's been a nuisance to the Philistines, but he hasn't actually fulfilled his role as judge. He's still seeking out the average, everyday Philistine life. He's seeking out the Philistine woman. He's not seeking out the Nazarite life, and so he falls in love with Delilah, a foreign woman, a Philistine, and the Philistine rulers see this opportunity to finally rid themselves of this nuisance. Delilah obviously doesn't love Samson nearly as much as he loves her, and so she takes the money and she begins to try to get Samson to reveal how is he so strong, which also suggests, contrary to all of your comics, he is not a muscular man, because they can't figure out how this guy is so strong. This guy, what is the secret to his strength? He obviously doesn't lift weights. What is the secret to his strength? There's something going on here. They can tell that there's something supernatural there. So how is he so strong, and how can he be subdued? And so Samson leads her, if you read this account, he leads her on this wild goose chase regarding his strength. He said, you know, tie me up with 7 fresh bowstrings, that'll do it. Doesn't do it. Use new ropes, that'll do it. Doesn't do it. Tie the 7 braids of my hair into a fabric loom, that'll do it. And he gets really elaborate with that one. That's a weird one, right? You're like, how did he come? But Samson loved riddles. If you read his stories, Samson had this weird fixation with riddles and games. He liked to play them, but he was very mad if he lost them. This is a competitive guy. He lost a riddle game, and he ends up killing 30 guys for their clothes. That's a different story. Again, he's an interesting person. But finally, we reread in verse 15 of chapter 16. She says to him, "How can you say I love you when you won't confide in me? This is the third time you have made a fool of me and haven't told me the secret of your great strength." With such nagging, she prodded him day after day until he was sick to death of it. So she accuses Samson after he's made up these stories, "Hey, you don't love me." And then she, their word, nags him day after day until finally, so I don't know how many times she brings this up, like, "What's the secret? What's the secret? What's the secret? Tell me the secret. Poke, poke, poke. Tell me your secret. Poke, poke, poke." But day after day, she's nagging him until verse 17. So he tells her everything. "No razor has ever been used on my head," he said, "because I have been a Nazarite, dedicated to God from my mother's womb. If my head were shaved, my strength would leave me, and I would become as weak as any other man." And when Delilah saw that he had told her everything, she sent word to the rulers of the Philistines, "Come back once more, he has told me everything." And so the rulers of the Philistines returned with the silver in their hands. And after putting him to sleep on her lap, she called for someone to shave off the 7 braids of his hair, and so began to subdue him, and his strength left him. And then she called Samson, "The Philistines are upon you." And he woke up from his sleep and thought, "I will go out as before and shake myself free, escape the bonds." But he did not know that the Lord had left him. And so the Philistines seized him, gouged out his eyes, and took him down to Gaza. And binding him with bronze shackles, they set him to grinding grain in the prison. Now, a couple things here. Samson assumes, I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but it's an odd assumption, but Samson assumes that his hair is what makes him strong. The emphasis, though, should be on the Nazarite. He's revealing to her that he's a Nazarite. That should be the revelation. But the revelation for Samson is that he thinks that his strength is actually in his hair, that his hair is what makes him strong, but that's not true. His hair isn't actually make him strong. I don't know if you've ever actually thought about this, but that's a weird assumption to make. His hair is not what makes him strong. Having hair on his head in no way gives him this supernatural strength. It was his willingness, however reluctant, to be used by God and remain a Nazarite and answer the call of God. That's what made him strong. His willingness, even though it was still reluctant, to be a part of what God was doing, that is why God allowed him to remain strong. His life demonstrates this tension and this battle and a significant reluctance and struggle to completely separate himself to God. Samson wasn't a good man. Samson wasn't a righteous man. But he never fully, even in all of that, he never fully rejected God's call. God called him to lead. God called him to judge. And even though reluctantly, even though there was a lot of tension there, even though he was not a good man, not a righteous man, we still know he led Israel. He was still doing it, although poorly and reluctantly, he was still doing it. And so as long as he was still following God's call, that God was still blessing him through this gift of strength. He never fully rejected it. But there's something in his words in verse 17 that I want you to see. It's not necessarily revealed in our English translations, but it is in the Hebrew. When we read the Bible, we don't hear inflection, we don't hear tone, but there is a tone and an inflection given in the Hebrew in this verse, in verse 17. And it actually answers the question that you might have been wondering. And the question that I wonder too, why would he tell Delilah, even if it's not true, even if his strength isn't actually in his hair, like from God's perspective, his strength isn't in his hair, but he thinks it is, right? He believes that it's in his hair. So why would he tell her? Why would he tell Delilah that it's there, right? She's proven that she's literally trying to take away his strength. She hasn't been hiding this from him. It's not like she's been very like coy about it. Like the very first question she said was, how can I make you not strong and tie you up? Like she's been very clear, and so we know that they're in a Philistine town. There are Philistines everywhere. The Philistines have expressed their desire to end his nuisance. They've been opposed to him since day one. So I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but why in the world does he give her the answer? If he actually thinks it's in his hair, why is he telling her, it's in my hair, go ahead and tie me up like you did the last time that you tried to betray me to the Philistines? Why is he actually answering this? And the answer is, in his words, in the Hebrew, in verse 17, he tells her everything, and he says, no razor has ever been used on my head, because I've been a Nazarite. That's the key, not the head, but that's not what he knows. Dedicated to God from my mother's womb. If my head were shaved, my strength would leave me, and I would become as weak as any other man. In the Hebrew, that should be read, if my head were shaved, my strength would leave me, and I would become as weak as any other man. And in that phrase, there is longing, and there is desire, and there is wishfulness in that phrase. The force of the words in Hebrew actually has intention and almost a begging, a wish of her, like looking into the distance and wishfully saying, I want to be like everyone else. I can't escape this. I can't do it myself. I want to be like everyone else. I just want to be an average Philistine. He wants her to cut his hair. He wants her to end his vow. It was involuntarily made, and so it needs to be involuntarily removed. He didn't want to be at odds with the Philistines any longer, even reluctantly. He just wanted to be one of them, and so he said, even wishfully, cut my hair, please. And in that moment, he rejected God's call to him completely. It was the final straw. It wasn't the cutting of the hair. It was the request, the begging to cut his hair, to express once and for all, I want to be normal. He rejected God's call. He gave himself over to being just another Philistine, and that's why his strength left him. And the symbol of it, the symbol of his separation to God, was removed by his own willingness. And so he wakes up weak. He can't escape. And instead, though, of becoming a normal Philistine like he wanted, he's captured, eyes gouged out, and sent to do hard labor. But look at verse 22. So they sent him to grind grain in the prison, blinded. Verse 22, but the hair on his head began to grow again after it had been shaved. So this point is significant, not because the strength was in the hair, but because Samson didn't continue shaving his head. But after that, he didn't continue shaving his head. It seems in his imprisonment that Samson has a heart change. And at rock bottom, he finally accepts God's call to his life, though now in very different circumstances than originally intended. And so he begins to allow, by his choice, his hair to grow out, indicating that he has recommitted himself to what God has called him to do. He is finally at rock bottom accepting his Nazarite status. And we know this because the author of Hebrews, in his long list of people demonstrating genuine faith in God, lists Samson among them, a guy who demonstrated no faith in God his entire life until this moment. In Hebrews chapter 11, verses 32 to 34, the author of Hebrews says, and what more shall I say about people who demonstrate genuine faith in God? I don't have time to tell you about Gideon, about Barak, Samson, and Jephthah, about David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, and gained what was promised, who shut the mouths of lions, quenched the fury of the flames, escaped the edge of the sword, whose weakness turned to strength, who became powerful in battle and routed foreign armies. And the author of Hebrews says, at the end of this story, of a man who demonstrated faithlessness, a rejection of God's call, a desire to not follow God at all, at the end of his story, Samson is listed among those who demonstrated in his life, at some point, genuine faith. And the only time that Samson could have demonstrated any type of faith to make it on this list is here at the end of his story, which is why the author points out in Judges that his hair begins to grow back. Not because the strength is in the hair, but because it's a metaphor for his commitment to and his faith in God, where he says, I was wrong. I'm going to trust you now. And he allows his hair to begin to grow back. So the Philistines throw a party in honor of their God and their capture of Samson. 3,000 people are there along with all the rulers of the Philistines. There's people on the roof of the temple, of their pagan temple, and it's packed inside. And they decide to bring Samson out to mock and humiliate him in their celebration. And this leads to Samson's most iconic and famous moment. Look at verse 25. So while they were in high spirits, they shouted, bring out Samson to entertain us. So they called Samson out of the prison, and he performed for them. When they stood him among the pillars, Samson said to the servant who held his hand, put me where I can feel the pillars that support the temple so that I may lean against them. And so now the temple was crowded with men and women. All the rulers of the Philistines were there, and on the roof were about 3,000 men and women watching Samson perform. And when Samson prayed to the Lord, Sovereign Lord, remember me. Please, God, strengthen me just one more time, and let me with one blow get revenge on the Philistines for my two eyes. And Samson reached toward the two central pillars on which the temple stood, embracing himself against them, his right hand on one, his left on the other. Samson said, let me die with the Philistines. And then he pushed with all his might, and down came the temple on the rulers and all the people in it. So he killed many more when he died than when he lived. So God allows Samson his strength one more time, with which he kills the Philistine rulers and officials, presumably ending the Philistine rule over the Israelites. So Samson died a Nazarite and a judge of Israel. But Samson's story is not one that we want to emulate. It's one that we want to learn from. It's one of tension and conflict about God's call in a man's life and that man's desires to do anything but follow God. And so there are a lot of lessons that we can learn from this. Among them, just briefly, but among them the truth that God will use even flawed, sinful men to accomplish his will. And just because God is using someone with influence doesn't mean that that person is godly. Just because something positive for God comes out of a person's leadership doesn't always mean that person is godly, because God will use flawed, sinful men to accomplish his purpose, and that doesn't mean his favor is on that person. He's not approving of that person. It's just God can use whomever he wants. So don't assume that positive results equals godliness, but instead thank God that he can and is and still does work despite people. We can learn that from this story. We can also see in this story that sin has consequences always. And Samson lived a life of consequences because of his sin, even though he was called by God. And ultimately, his death was a consequence of sin and his choices as well. Sin has consequences always. It has natural consequences, but those can be avoided by not sinning. This is something else that we can learn. But those aren't necessarily the lessons I want to really focus on this morning, but they're there. Don't assume God can use anybody, and he will use anybody, even flawed, sinful men. So don't assume that the product of their leadership, if positive towards Christians or God, means that that is a godly person. Because I think we have seen clearly, even in our country, that's not true. But God will use who he wants to use to accomplish his purposes, but it is better if we get on board with it. And sin always has consequences, and the only way to avoid the consequences of sin is to not sin. But sin always has consequences. But this morning, I want us to learn specifically from that conflict between God's call in his life and who Samson wanted it to be, because that conflict, that tension is inside all of us. That expressed desire, I just want to be like everyone else, or I just want to have what I want, that is a temptation and is a tendency and a desire that you may have or you may experience. I want to be like everybody else. Following God doesn't make me like everybody else, or following God doesn't give me what I want. And you may experience that desire, you may experience that tension, but for the believer, it goes in direct contradiction to God's call in our lives. So living a life of obedience to God is what a believer is called to, but when we live a life of obedience to God, it will put us in direct tension, in direct contradiction with our own feelings and our own desires, as well as the values and the tendencies of the culture around us. And so you're going to feel that tension. You're going to feel that, I just want to be like everybody else. I just want to be able to live and do just this one time. I want to be like everybody else. I just want to have what I want just this one time. But if I follow God, if I obey God, it's not going to give me what I want, or it's going to put me at odds with everybody else around me. And I just want to be like them. I want to blend in to the culture around me. And this is because by nature, we and our culture have a tendency, because of sin, we have a tendency towards self-satisfaction and excess. John calls that the lust of the flesh. We have a tendency toward discontent and being dissatisfied with where God has us. It's called the lust of the eyes. And we have this tendency towards self-sufficiency. It's the pride of life. Everyone is born with those tendencies, self-satisfaction and excess, discontent, and self-sufficiency. We are all born with those tendencies. However, our culture gives itself into and over to those things, over to those tendencies, because it is rooted in sin. And so our culture is one of self-satisfaction and excess, one of discontent and being frustrated with those who have more than you. It is one of self-sufficiency. I can make myself, I can guide myself, I can live my own life. Don't tell me what your truth is, because I'm going to live my truth. That is what our culture does. It gives itself over to it, and that temptation, that tendency is inside us because we were born in the same culture. We're born in the same sin. And so it's inside us. And this natural tendency will put us at odds with God's call in our lives to live separated to Him, to be offering our lives as sacrifices to Him, like Paul tells us to do, to be made new in our attitude and our actions, our lifestyles, to do whatever we do in word or deed. There is a tension between who we are and what we feel pulled towards, but also to do everything in word or deed for the glory of God. There is a tension and a conflict inside every single one of us. But even if that tension is there, that's what you were called to do. Even if that tension is there that says, I want to be like everybody else, I just want to give in, I just want to have what I want, I have this one desire, I just want to find sufficiency in it, or I want to find satisfaction in it, I want the answer to it, and I just this one thing, but you were called to be separate when you placed your faith in God. You were called to be separated to God. We were called to do the hard thing and live a life separated to Him, in contradiction to those natural desires. Look at how Paul just beautifully says it in Ephesians chapter 2, verses 17 to 24. He says, so I tell you this, and insist on it in the Lord, you must no longer live as the Gentiles do, in the futility of their thinking. They are darkened in their understanding, and they're separated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them due to the hardening of their hearts. So having lost all sensitivity, they have given themselves over to sensuality so as to indulge in every kind of impurity, and they're full of greed. That, however, is not the way of life you learned when you heard about Christ and were taught in Him in accordance with the truth that is in Jesus. You were taught with regard to your former way of life to put off your old self, which is being corrupted by its deceitful desires, instead to be made new in the attitude of your minds and to put on the new self created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness. And Peter tells us that we have already spent enough time doing what the godless and the sinful do. We've spent enough time, however short it was, living according to the tendencies of the world, but God has called you to be separated to Him. And so Paul says there is that tension, and you're going to see that tension. You're going to see how they live their life, and you're going to feel pulled to that, but that's not what you learned then. That's not what you learn when you place your faith in God, and that tension is there, but you have to live separated. You have to separate yourself from those tendencies and live as God has called you. And you may want the enjoyment of living like your neighbors who can do whatever they want. They're not here today. They can do whatever they want, right, when it comes to what God has called us to. They can live without conscience. They can live without concern. But that's not what God called you to when you place your faith in Him. You may wish you could just compromise or give in or let up a little bit or just be a little looser in different areas and not so rigid in what God is asking of you and find satisfaction your way or find excess your way. But that is not what God called you to. And living that way, Samson shows us, will have very real consequences. God has called you to something greater through your belief, and that will put you in direct tension with how you sometimes feel and how the world lives. But I promise you, it is greater. What God has called you to is greater. It's better, and it matters in eternity when we live our life separated to God, and He has good reasons for every better thing that He has called you to. So if you have genuine belief in God, then live like it. Follow His call in your life, no matter what it means, and overcome that tension by giving yourself fully in devotion to God. This is an intentional, active process where you devote to pursue godliness through prayer, through study, through obedience and faith. There is going to be that tension when God calls you, but you must not give in to it, and you must live separated to God. Devote yourself to it. We're going to pray, and when I pray this time, it's going to be on the screen, but I'm actually going to pray through a few verses from Psalm 119 because they apply so well, and I think it's a good way for us to resolve this and commit ourselves. And so if you want to follow along with me, you can pray with your eyes open this morning and read these words as I pray through them for us, and then we will sing to close. But I would ask you to pray along with me. First, God, I just thank You for having a plan, having a purpose, and a design. And I ask that You help us to live in that plan, in that design, in that purpose. God, would You teach us? Teach us the way that You have declared to be true and right, the way that You have decreed, the way that is good and honoring to You. Teach it to us so that we internalize it, not just in our minds, but in our hearts. So that it comes out through our actions, through our words, through our behaviors, that we would follow it every single day to the very end, that You would teach it to us each individually through our devotion to You, that we would stay committed to it and separated from the world to You to the very last day that we breathe on this earth. Give us understanding, an understanding of how to handle what You have called us to in the very unique situations that each and every single one of us confronts and will find ourselves in even tomorrow. Give us understanding so that we can keep Your law in those situations and obey it with all of our heart, not part of our heart, not a little bit of our heart, but everything inside us, that we understand this is how God has called me to act and behave and think and obey in this specific situation. So give us, God, please give us that understanding. Direct us in the path of Your commands. Lead us when we choose. Lead us to choose the path that You have placed in front of us, that is the one that follows Your commands. When we see choice, when we see a diversion in life, when paths go different directions, God, will You guide us into the one that most follows Your word and most follows Your desires, because that's where we want to delight. That's where we love being in Your word, God, but we have a tendency to be away from it. We love being in Your plan, but we have a tendency to move far away from it and go to our own plan and find those things. But we delight in Your path, and so will You help us be faithful to it and follow it and true to it and pursue it. And turn our heart towards Your desires, towards Your guidelines, towards Your moral character, towards Your righteousness, not towards what we feel we want, what we hope to have, that the desires that root ourselves in our heart because of sin. Turn us to You and not them. Turn our eyes away from those things that are worthless, but they look good. They look desirable, they look entertaining, they look enjoyable, but they're temporary and they're fleeting and they're not worthwhile. They're worthless. Turn our eyes away from those desires. Preserve our life according to your word, God. Give us the ability to live a life of successful godliness because you have promised that you would be faithful to us as we are faithful to you. So fulfill your promise to your servants, God. Fulfill your promise to us so that we will honor you with our lives, that we will fear you, we will respect you, we will live in awe of you, and the people around us will notice that we do the same, and they will also fear you, honor you, respect you because of how we live our lives, because of how we give ourselves in devotion to you. Take away the disgrace that we dread, the fear that we have that if we follow you, that we won't get what we want, we won't have what we desire, we won't have the success that we may be missing out, we may be in a situation we don't want to be in. Please remove that fear that we have that causes us to not obey, because your laws are actually good, desirable, and right. So give us a longing for your word, for your guidelines, for your truth, and because you are good and righteous and true, preserve our lives, God. Every single day, preserve us. Give us another opportunity, another chance day after day after day to honor you with what you've given us and to fight that tension and fight that contradiction in our hearts that says, I want to go here, but God wants me here. Preserve us and give us another day, another chance and opportunity to honor you and the courage to do it. I love you, God. And I pray this on behalf of all of my brothers and sisters in your name.